And now, a message from the future from our presenter, Paula Ann Porter-Jones.
Welcome to A Future by the Sea, where life in the Caribbean is metropolitan, international, and actively slowing the effects of climate change. Business is agile, governance is collaborative, and civil society sets the bar for adapting to our changing climate. The small island states of the Caribbean are once again at the center of economic life of the Western world. In this episode, we're living the dream and thinking about how that vision for life in the Caribbean can become reality. From ODI and the University of the West Indies, this is Caribbean Comeback, where we tell the stories of hope, recovery, and innovation that make the small island developing states of the Caribbean world leaders in climate resilience. I'm Paula Ann Porter-Jones, a broadcaster from Kingston, Jamaica.
And I'm Emily Wilkinson, Senior Research Fellow at ODI and Co-Director of the Caribbean Resilience and Recovery Knowledge Network.
Emily, it is our final episode in the series, but before we look forward, can you give us a snapshot of the issues we've covered so far? Because they're all crucial to how we envision the future.
Sure, we've looked at a lot of really important issues at the hard reality that Caribbean islands face now and will continue to face in the future, bearing the brunt of climate change, which they're not really responsible for. We've looked at different kinds of natural hazards that threaten the region, which can wipe out years of development and investment in infrastructure, wipe out people's livelihoods. And we've looked at how vulnerable people, vulnerable groups, children, migrant groups, the elderly and disabled can be doubly impacted by these events. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we've looked at the sort of big macroeconomic picture and why these countries are so vulnerable today and the relationship that has to their colonial past and why it's so important to look at history and to understand how risk has built up over time.
Those are so many challenges. That's so much negative, and that's just a snapshot. Are there any real stories of positivity that we can find in all of this?
Yes, definitely. One of the things that has really struck me throughout this podcast is the enormous scale of ambition within the Caribbean. There's really a very positive tone to a lot of these discussions. You know, we've heard a lot of really exciting examples. In Dominica, for example, they have developed this very credible and very ambitious plan to become the world's first climate resilient nation by 2030. That's just around the corner, really. We speak more about this in episode 3, but there's really a lot to be hopeful about, I think.
Okay, so let's begin in Dominica and listen to one very practical way that citizens are being encouraged to be as individually resilient as possible.
Climate change cannot defeat us.
How do I prepare for the approaching hurricane season? The first 15 days after a disaster are critical, but it's too late to prepare for this after disaster strikes. That's why I'm making sure my family has enough drinking water and non-perishable food to last us at least 2 weeks, plus a first aid kit and battery-powered transistor radio. I'll top that up with a flashlight, extra batteries, a waterproof case for my important documents, and a whistle to signal for help if needed. The time to prepare is now.
This hurricane season, be fully prepared. This message is powered by the Commonwealth of Learning and the Climate Resilience Execution Agency for Dominica, CREED.
So we have individuals preparing themselves for the impact of disasters, but how does that scale up to work at the policy level for the whole of the island? Here's Francine Barron, CEO for CREED, the national agency responsible for climate resilience strategy in Dominica.
We have to be able to be nimble enough to deal with whatever threat that comes our way, be it climate related or otherwise. We also are islands. We're surrounded by water. We have vast marine reserves, and we need to be able to properly utilize those resources in a sustainable way for the benefit of our citizens. How do we move to a situation where, for example, we can be energy efficient? So we're looking, for example, in Dominica at moving into 100% renewable energy. So in Dominica, by 2030, we expect to be relying only on renewable energy. So we're looking at geothermal, hydro, and solar to be able to achieve that goal of 100% domestic renewable energy production by 2030. So this has the added advantage of not just being energy secure, but also doing it in a way that is eco-friendly.
Okay, I'd like to unpack that a little more, Emily. What does economic resilience mean for an island that is susceptible to hurricanes and earthquakes with just over 70,000 inhabitants?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to look at this issue in terms of how disasters and climate change affect economies, like understand the scale of the problem first. So I wanted to share with you some figures on the economic costs of climate change in the region. This one, I think, is staggering. If we carry on the way we are on the current development path without sufficient effort to mitigate climate change, it's estimated that the impacts will swallow about 10% of the regional economy by 2050. That's $22 billion. And it's not hard to imagine what a huge boost it would be to all small island developing states if they could spend the money that they earn, that their economies produce, on education, on infrastructure, on welfare, rather than constantly having to deal with these disasters. Dominica, as Francine described, has naturally occurring geothermal energy and plans to develop a geothermal energy plant and run this alongside solar and wind energy, become 100% renewable energy dependent by 2030, which is, you know, it's a small island, but that's, you know, a huge step. And not only is that good news for Dominica, it reduces the emissions in the region and means that Dominica doesn't need to be importing fossil fuels, which makes it more resilient in a crisis, not depending on those imports. And going even further, this is an investment opportunity for international businesses. It's an opportunity for the lenders, for the World Bank to get involved and support these projects. So hopefully we'll create a virtuous circle. That's the idea.
I like that. I like that. Because that's a form of extraction that's both environmentally safe and highly beneficial to the Dominican economy. But there's another angle to consider, isn't there? When we think about the natural environment of the Caribbean islands, how about nature-based solutions that actually reverse the effects of climate change, Emily?
Caribbean islands are doing a lot of thinking about this. And it's interesting. It's a model that can be scaled up and replicated around the world. I asked Nicole Leotold to explain more. Nicole is the Executive Director of the Caribbean Natural Resources Institute, also known as CANARI. CANARI has spent around 30 years promoting participatory approaches to natural resource management.
So nature-based solutions to climate change is really talking about how we use natural ecosystems to respond to climate change. In terms of two things, both how can ecosystems help us to absorb excess carbon that's in the atmosphere? So we talk about carbon sinks, where natural ecosystems act like a sponge and pull up all this excess carbon that's being produced and causing climate change. Other natural ecosystems are things along our coast, for example, the coral reefs, seagrass beds, and mangroves, which all work together to do several interesting things. And they also help to protect our coastline from sea level rise, the impacts of storms. They buffer us from the impacts of climate change. Now, what's really important to just add is that these nature-based solutions are local solutions. So they need to be tailored to specific localities, and they need to be implemented with local people. So the beautiful thing about nature-based solutions is that they're really well suited to also deliver economic benefits and livelihood benefits.
You know, the irony of this is not lost on me. We've spent generations cutting down forests and damaging coastlines in the pursuit of profit, when these very things are at the heart of our future survival.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And having these amazing natural resources that absorb carbon could actually be the key to repositioning the economic power of the Caribbean region in the global economy.
How?
Well, it's all about what people are referring to as the blue economy. So the idea that SIDS, small island developing states, are actually large ocean states. They have big areas of surrounding water. And that traditionally has meant that there are lots of activities, marine-based activities, fishing, tourism on the beaches, diving, and so on. But if we think a bit bigger than that about how the global economy is structured and begin to actually put a value on these resources, on the carbon absorption potential of the ocean and the biodiversity in the islands and in the ocean, then conserving that begins to have an important value and something that other countries, that globally, we might be able to protect or we might be able to pay for. So in the future, we might see, for example, the commodification of some of those assets and, for example, the natural carbon sinks being traded with companies or countries that want to offset their carbon footprint. But we might also see in the future a treaty around the protection of natural assets for the common global good and some kind of transfer of funds to countries that are prepared to protect and conserve those natural resources.
And maybe we are finally seeing the value of the coral reefs and the mangroves enough to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's beginning to come out in the way that we think about that protection as an active and collaborative task for an entire society, not just governments.
So there really needs to be much more engagement in decisions about the environment. And the more people are consulted and the more people are involved in those decisions, that can only be a good thing.
That seems like a huge change, especially because our states are relatively young, only released from colonialism 50 or so years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really impressive and public consultation is really important. We talk about it all the time in international development and climate change circles. You know, this is the key to good policy. But it has a pretty patchy reputation here in the UK and in many other so-called developed countries where we have very relatively low rates of public consultation. Really, people don't get involved in decision making. There's no platform for them to do that. So in some ways, this is incredibly progressive. So Nicole makes another point here, which is particularly interesting, I think, in relation to recovery from the COVID crisis.
I think one more area to emphasize is the importance of Caribbean governments enhancing their support to micro, small, and medium enterprises as part of their COVID-19 recovery response. And in particular, to highlight the importance of supporting informal, so not registered, micro enterprises, and those micro enterprises that are in the local community, grassroots micro enterprises that are based on the use of nature, whether it's ecotourism or craft or fishing or agriculture. Much of the poor and vulnerable in the Caribbean actually practice these informal livelihood strategies that are based on nature. And their needs must be addressed as part of our response.
You know, one of the things that we've seen happen in Jamaica is where people have adjusted to based on what's happening with the issues with climate change and the pandemic. So, for example, there's a drink we call Irish Moss, which is made with sea moss. And we used to have a lot of people selling it on the streets, and that's where you could get it. And then we had the lockdown with a pandemic, and somehow some other persons picked up on that, and there's now an adjustment. In many cases, you can now get Irish moss by ordering online. So there, some people have websites in that way. Other persons have their maybe Instagram stores where you can purchase. And even that whole use of social media has been good for small farmers who've partnered with people who drive, who pick up the produce from wherever they are and deliver them to customers. So we see where we have an approach that's in tune with the unpredictable nature of the weather, the environment, the different things that are being thrown at us, and businesses now being flexible around those conditions.
Yeah, we see similar things happening in the UK. So small businesses that have survived the pandemic by adapting to the circumstances, by being really very flexible, very nimble, selling products online, restaurants turning into takeaway services, that kind of thing. That we're seeing those small businesses really do better than some of the really large businesses.
Well, you know, we could almost think of this as a nature-based version of the way that the digital world has revolutionized the job market on a larger scale.
Yeah, and that's where technology holds such huge potential for the Caribbean, I think.
Before we go there, though, let's talk about what was always thought of as the great economic prize for the Caribbean: tourism. Well, certainly for those of us in Jamaica, it is a huge economic blessing, but it's not without significant problems, though.
Yeah, we've seen the massive impact that a reduction in tourism is having on the economies of Caribbean islands. Estimates range from like $27 billion US dollars to $44 billion, worst case scenario, in terms of losses in tourism revenue. So this is really huge. And tourism is very vulnerable to these kinds of shocks, to the pandemic, and then, of course, hurricanes and other extreme weather events. So it's a fickle business and puts enormous pressure on precious Caribbean coastlines and natural resources, which, you know, we've heard during this podcast have been really badly damaged by the coastal developments that have taken place. So it's a double-edged sword, really, and Caribbean islanders are now looking for ways to pivot away from mainstream tourism, from mass tourism. And I think there are some really encouraging and creative developments afoot. I asked the Vice Chancellor of the University of the West Indies, Sir Hilary Beckles, for his vision of the future.
The Caribbean has tremendous potential. It has tremendous energy. There's a tremendous sense of optimism in the future based on taking responsibility for ourselves and planning the future. We have our hands firmly on the climate change issues. It is an existential threat. We have a tourism industry, but beaches are disappearing meter by meter. Some beaches have completely disappeared altogether. So here is your main industry, but the primary resource of that industry, which is the magnificence of the Caribbean beaches, they are under threat. Then there is the issue around other forms of tourism, and we are becoming very innovative in pursuit of other non-beach forms of tourism. Then there's the issue of the digital transformation. The capacity of this region to generate the human resources to launch a digital revolution. The skill sets are there and growing. The university is adding tremendous value to that science and technology infrastructure. When it is fully rolled out, and it can be rolled out with support from the international community, and the international community understands this. ECLAC, the Economic Council for Latin America and the Caribbean, they understand it. The World Bank is calling for it, an injection of resources for digital transformation to build out new frontiers of the economy in information services, data management, and so on. So these are emerging and incipient industries that, with the right injection, can actually take a much higher trajectory.
It's a lot of food for thought there, Emily. What are the other forms of tourism that Sir Hilary mentions, and how is it connected to a digital revolution?
So yeah, just in the way that Airbnb has changed the holiday letting market and landscape around the world, there are other ways that tourism can be disrupted and changed with the digital economy. And one thing that COVID has taught us is that the traditional office thing, going into an office every day, is really a thing of the past. And we're not sure to what extent people are going to go back to their offices. But what that means is if you have a good broadband connection and a good sort of setup, you can work from wherever you like. And so I think the move of Barbados, Dominica, to give people year work visas so they're allowed to go and relocate and work in these countries without a complicated visa application process is really incredibly encouraging. This is really adaptability in practice. And this idea of the digital nomad, as I think they're being called, is, I think, going to be good for the environment as well, because these are not people, unlike the tourists that go on all-inclusive holidays, they don't want a luxury beachfront hotel, and they will stay for longer, spend more money on local businesses. So I think these are really encouraging signs that Caribbean countries are taking the opportunity presented by COVID and this kind of disruption to office work life and doing something really positive with it. And it's definitely more sustainable than the traditional short stay tourism, which also relies on more frequent long haul flights. So this is really a win-win.
It is. And it's not just with tourism. There's so many ways in which that whole remote working concept and execution just helps. Look here, I am remote working in Jamaica with a production team in London.
Yeah, the digital infrastructure is, as I understand it, pretty good across the Caribbean. That opens up huge possibilities, really, particularly for young people who want to work in digital jobs remotely. There are these services like Fiverr, which I understand lots of young Caribbeans have signed up to. It's really important, and we mentioned this in an earlier podcast, education, that people are sort of equipped to take advantage of these opportunities and are eager to do so. And education itself, we can see changing as well. There's going to be more and more programs delivered online, which means that young people don't have to move to another island in order to study. This opens it up to many more people who may not have been able to do that in the past. And it means that SIDS can kind of keep more of their homegrown talent, that people aren't moving away.
It seems that even with the impact of COVID, there are some really good innovations building momentum. So what do we need then, Emily, to realize all of this potential? And what are the threats we have to be looking out for?
Well, there's no doubt that the impact of COVID means that SIDS are going to have to find solutions of their own and look to the future in a world that is becoming riskier. But I think COVID has forced all of us to look at these questions, to look at the economic development models that have persisted for a number of years and question whether they're really, you know, fit for purpose. By looking at these issues again, I think we will see opportunities. The political landscape is changing. We've seen with the COVID crisis that there's been less global solidarity. The multilateral system has in some ways failed. But regionally, I think the Caribbean is doing really well, and there's been a huge amount of cooperation and solidarity and leadership in responding to COVID.
Well, let me throw the question at you, Emily. You are in a position to see so much of this happening. What is your vision for the future? What does a Caribbean comeback look like to you?
Well, this is an auspicious year. We have COP26, the climate change conference, just around the corner, with the UK hosting. The UK is also head of the G7 this year. So there's plenty more that the UK government can do to strengthen and support Caribbean islands and recognise the responsibility that it has for doing so. There is a a narrative forming around the very special structural problems that Caribbean islands face due to no fault of their own, you know, the location in the tropics, the colonial legacy, which puts so many people and the infrastructure and assets at risk and means that, you know, the economies have developed in such a way that they're not naturally diversified and able to flex and respond. And all of these things, the responding to these things will require huge ingenuity and entrepreneurialism from within the Caribbean, but also support from outside. And I think there's increasing recognition that that support is warranted. I think there is a real opportunity to demonstrate soft power, to demonstrate influence that the UK can have in these small islands and small islands that have such a close relationship to the UK because of the colonial history. So, you know, really a positive future, I think, that will depend on action within the region and support from the outside.
I think that's such a good perspective on which to wrap things up. It's a positive future for the Caribbean. Emily Wilkinson, thank you so much for taking us through this Caribbean comeback. I'm going to be watching for the outcomes of COP26, paying great attention.
Thanks, Paula Anne, and thanks also to my colleague and co-director of the Caribbean Resilience and Recovery Knowledge Network, Donovan Campbell, for co-hosting our previous episodes. And to Francine Barron, Nicole Leotode, and Hilary Beckles for taking part in this episode. There's a host of information related to the issues covered in this series that you can find at www.odi.org/resilient-islands.
I'm Paula Anne Porter-Jones, and thank you for listening. Caribbean Comeback is produced by Freya Hellier for Loftus Media, and the assistant producer is Alexandra Quinn.